Good evening, one and all. Yes, here we are, halfway, well, more than halfway through. No, it's halfway through another week. Nearly, not far off, the end of July. I'm telling you, whizzes through time. And I am here, and so is my guest. Now, I was talking to my guest before the show starts, sort of saying about the weather and everything like that. And it's been pretty hot in America, as we know, and lots of issues and that, but not as hot as in Europe and not as hot as in Great Britain. It's been up to 111, I think it was, in one time the weekend or something like that in England. A bit cooler today, but of course you're just not used to it. Though it's not far off that we're not used to it. It's been very similar the last 5, 10, 15, 20 years to sort of like where I am in Connecticut, like East Coast heat-wise. Not quite the snow, because you've got the Gulf Stream, of course, which keeps it a bit warmer over there. But the actual summer weather has been pretty like it. In fact, as I was saying before the show started, I think it's like 25 of the last 30 years in the south of England, where my family are, hosepipe bans in the summer. You can't do your hosepipe because there's just not the rain and the water and the heat's there in the summer. But never mind. I am here, and as I said, so is my guest. Now, yeah, we say about a lot of things, especially this year. We've had a lot of doctors, a lot of lawyers, and as I keep telling you, that's because lawyers, after all, tell stories all the time. And when it comes to doctors, now they've got laptops, people don't have to struggle reading their writing, and that's why they're now writing books. A lot of other people we've had who've gone through the journalism part, through that sort of side of a business, and then perhaps when they've retired or towards the end, they've started writing fiction. And my guest is one of those, but he's a little bit more than that. Let's face it, he was named as a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Yeah, that's not bad, is it? Anyway, they better introduce him. We'll chat about it a bit more, because on the show today, I have the one and only John Ritter. Hi, John. How are you doing?
Hi, Barry. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So, I get on to off the journalism bit, but you're one of these people who basically... You did your degree and then took a couple of years off, 2 years of hitchhiking. You just wanted to see the world before you started work. Was that it?
Yeah, and I just wasn't quite ready to knuckle down at that point. You know, that was the '70s. Things were pretty wild and crazy still. You know.
Yep. And remember it very well. but I mean, in doing that. That you must have, you did sort of a lot of part-time jobs and, like carpenter's helper, meat cutter, I read, and stuff like that. But you must have seen a lot of different things and experienced a lot of different places and adventures and stuff like that, which I think might have got you ready for when you finally went into your career, i.e. the newspaper business, because you knew what made a good story and you knew how stories develop and stuff like that. Do you think that helped you?
I do, and I think as far as any degree goes, there's book learning and what you learn in school, and then when your real education starts when you get out
exactly.
And go to work.
Totally. I mean, yeah. I always say to people, I remember interviewing a lot of people who've had, I was in the IT side, and I remember interviewing a lot of people who got degrees in IT, but when it came to sort of like common sense and stuff like that, they had no idea. These days, you just taught to pass exams. I mean, that's it. There is no... It's like when you phone up a help desk, they've got 20 questions to ask you. And if you ask them something different, they have no idea. And that's what it's like with
exams.
Right. You learn to, this question needs this answer, sort of. And even multiple choice now, so it's even easier. You have a 1 in 4 chance of getting it right, even if you don't know it, sort of thing. You started off in a small paper?
A couple of small papers in... Upstate New York, yeah, and I was with a large. The second one's in Rochester with a large company called Gannett.
Yeah,
and that was the company that started USA Today, and I was fortunate enough to get on with them and stayed with them till I quit. Yeah.
Wow, but when you did the newspaper, wasn't it around the time with Nixon and him resigning and that? So there was, I mean, the news was,
Yeah.
Shattering, world-shattering news at those times.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, it's look what we've got. Look what we've got now, Barry.
Well,
I mean,
oh no, I was thinking as soon as I said that, I thought to myself, but yeah, that's nothing compared to what we've got now. Oh my goodness!
Right.
Every time I speak to my family or friends in you know the UK or in Europe and stuff like that, they can't understand how he's still out of jail. He's still out.
Yeah,
of jail. What's
exactly.
The American legal system? What do they do? And I get it all the time. And what can I say? I just don't know what to say.
I don't have an answer either. I don't think, you know, it's crazy. And look at our dysfunctional government.
Oh,
you know?
Crikey.
It's like, yeah. No, so.
And the thing that gets me is, don't mean to get on my soapbox right now, but all these people, you know, the price of gas and the supply chain, that's all the president's fault. No, it's not. It's a global issue. I mean,
the president doesn't have much control.
Yeah, if you look at the prices of gas around the world, America's still second or third cheapest. You know,
cheapest, that's right.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah,
it's ridiculous.
And we're complaining,
$9 a gallon at least, you know, in some of these, UK it's like $7 a gallon. But it's, oh no, it's the president's fault, it's this person's fault. It's look outside America, there is a world.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh dear.
No, we tend to be very provincial. Americans do, you know. We don't look at the broader global issues enough.
Right, I've been here 22 years now, and I say this all the time. You know, I just can't comprehend how people. It's like half the people are like ostriches sticking their head in the sand, you know. And blaming people that have nothing to do with it and that sort of thing. As I said in the warm-up bit there, at the start-up bit, you know, you did a lot of sort of, the reporting you did was in environment, education, and politics, aviation, and stuff like that. But you were, in 1995, along with a colleague, named as a Pulitzer Prize finalist. And that was in investigative reporting, which obviously led you into the sort of books that you write, perhaps.
Possibly. I mean, it was just all part of the, you know, the continuing education. But yeah, I was kind of unexpectedly asked to join this other reporter and look into this kind of what seemed to be a run-of-the-mill people died air crash,
right?
And one thing led to another and it became a good story. And yeah, I mean, that's how things happen in that business. You know,
yeah,
they're not too predictable.
No,
you know?
No. I mean, yeah. You everything looks, cut and all sorted and stuff like that. And then, a rock gets turned over or something, and suddenly it's far from being straightforward. And that's how it goes, and that's how life is, really.
Yeah, but you know, I got to tell you, I mean, I had a nice career in journalism, no question. But fiction writing is really it's like apples and oranges to journalism. I mean, my learning curve was incredibly steep because I didn't come from a creative writing program or anything like that.
Right.
So you know, but notwithstanding, a lot of journalists do make the transition because you do have skills and you do have some of the training and the discipline they need to do it.
And I think that's part of it, the discipline. I mean, when I've spoken to people before, it's the discipline of a deadline, the discipline of perhaps number of word count and stuff like that. But on the other hand, the opposite hand is when you do the paper, it's almost like a pricey version. Whereas when you're writing a fiction book, you're having to sort of paint the picture more with words. And so it actually gets bigger.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's true. And, you know, the other thing is people talk about, fiction writers talk about writer's block, you know. They just, you know, sitting and they're just blocked. They can't move forward. Well, I don't know. I just never bought into that because number one, I never really suffered from it. But number two, I think it's a block that that it's self-perpetuating and you just got to let your self-conscious do the work and you know, that block will, you know, be over. I mean, it's overhyped. I think so too.
My view is
that's because I didn't suffer from it. I don't know. Go ahead.
I can totally understand that. My view is that the characters just don't want to talk to you that day. Perhaps they, you know, because I got this thing that the characters talk to you all the time and lead you down different paths, and minor characters want major roles. And some even demand their own book. And you know, for whatever reason, perhaps they want you to do something the day before. You didn't listen to them, and they say, well, I'm not going to talk to you tomorrow. You know, you've upset me. I didn't talk to you. And that's it. Because, as you say, if you just let it go and let it flow and you just go along with it, then you're right. I've never suffered from writer's block like that. You know, the odd sort of paragraph or two that I've just sort of stopped and then gone back over, but not like, oh, sure. People say, I'll just sit down here and I can't, nothing's coming out and I keep tearing up paper and that. Never like that. The characters lead you. You just got to be available to listen to them and awake enough.
Receptive,
that's the word I'm looking for, yeah. Receptive to do it. Matt.
Well, you know, and the other thing, if you're trying to organize a book, you're dealing with characters, plot, you know, scenes, you know, any number of dozens of scenes, organization, and you know, if you're blocked at a particular point, there's always something else you could do.
Of course there is.
You know, I mean, it's so. I don't know. I think it's overwrought. I think it's oversold.
I totally agree with you. Talking about stuff like that, the actual book. Then, what finally pushed you to write your debut book?
Well, I've been at it for a number of years, 5-6 years, and I'd actually turned out a manuscript that I'm actually planning to get back to at some point that I couldn't interest any agents in. And so I took a break, and then I thought, well, you know, let's give a stab at a first person crime book. You know, maybe that's a little actually, frankly, between you and me, maybe that's a little easier. Maybe I can pull that off.
Yeah.
And it turns out it wasn't any easier. But the other thing about me, Barry, is as the more I wrote, the better I got. And by the time I turned my attention to that, I was a much better writer than in the beginning when I started writing fiction.
You learn,
so, yeah, exactly. It's learned by doing. It's so I also had the benefit of a freelance editor I worked with before I even started trolling for agents, and he helped me a lot. So you know, one thing led to another, and I actually was able to get the thing published.
Right. Well, this book of yours, Fatal Conceit, is it based on a true incident?
No.
Okay, because I read it and it said,
fiction,
I thought it was, as I read it, you know, a case of a notorious double homicide, and I thought, I can't remember something like that. That explains why I can't remember.
You know, maybe notorious was a poor choice of words. I see what you mean by that. But the only thing it was literally, for a number of years, I'd had this thought in my head that you could write a story that was based on a videotaped murder.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that was literally the kernel of it. And you know, things just expand and explode from there. You know, but that was literally the kernel of it, and that was the sort of the seed, and it ended up being the you know, the crime that sort of the book revolved around, right? So
I mean, it's why I said that, because it's like based on this couple that were found dead during sex in San Francisco, sort of thing like that.
That's right.
But you bring in a couple of great characters. Beaupré, is that how you say it?
Beaupré, the detective.
Yeah.
Beaupré,
I mean, he's got his own issues. I got the impression.
Yes, he does, and you know, both his family and the woman he ends up falling in love with, and some issues that he had in his previous career as a police officer. So he's a complicated guy,
right?
You know, but he's pretty straightforward, and you know, he doesn't take himself too seriously, and he's sort of light on the touch as far as the reader goes. He's got some humor, you know, and which I thought was very important.
I
thought that
totally
was very crucial. Yeah. So
So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of twists and turns in it with the other characters and drug cartels and casino, obviously casinos, and even sort of Afghan refugees and all that sort of stuff. Did you have sort of like a plot that, well, I'm going to start with this and I'm going to end up with this, or did it sort of just wind and bring these other sort of different scenarios into it?
Well, when I started, I think, as a lot of writers do, I wrote a sort of a, for lack of a better word, a treatment, you know, just plotted out how this thing was going to play out. And it, I can only say that it changed radically in over the course of it. New characters were born, plots changed. It was like, you know, and that's, I don't understand that every writer doesn't work the same, but that's kind of how I do it. I get a really rough, basic plan, and then I plunge in, and then it just changes unbelievably
just
in the process.
The characters,
I totally
agree.
Characters, I mean, and the plot. Yeah.
And the plot. Yeah, I mean, I had, I've used this before. I wish I could remember her name. She was quite a well-known historical romance writer, and she came on the show, must be about 4 or 5 years ago, with her, I think it's like her 24th or 25th book. And we were talking about this, you know, about how the sort of characters do and everything like that. And she said to you, I'll have to tell you this, she says, I tried to kill off this character in my latest book 6 times, and the character wouldn't die. She said, I had to rewrite the whole plot. This character that wouldn't die.
There's a perfect example. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I mean, authors know about this, but you try talking to people, you know, who don't write or wouldn't understand about this, and they think you're mad. But
yeah.
I suppose we are in a way.
But you know, these things take a life of their own.
Yeah.
That's what people don't understand that either. They take a life of their own, and if they get to a point, and it, you know, if the next what's supposed to happen next is not precisely what you thought it originally it was, there's a reason for that, and probably a good one.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh yeah.
So
yeah. I mean,
so you
yeah,
change, you change course. Yeah.
You literally have. I mean, I couldn't never be you occasionally. You have these people that plot every single thing, you know, that before they start. And I remember there was one lady who, I think it was something else historically sort of thing, but she had her room in where she did her writing with sort of notelets stuck all over the wall of, you know, it's a romance sort of thing. And this
mm-hmm.
one had a relationship
mm-hmm.
with this one, and this one was illegitimate son of this one. And she had the whole of her wall plotted out like this, so she knew how the family. I could never do. I get really bored doing that.
Well, you can't expect to have all of your great ideas up front.
No.
You know, I mean, as you get further into it, you know, stuff happens in your mind and your subconscious works, and these characters work on you, and you have, you know, an idea will come. Oh, you know, light bulbs go off all the time. You know?
A number of people who keep writing pads next to their bed at night because suddenly they get this.
Yeah.
This idea.
You got it. You'll forget. I'll forget them. I'll have a great idea in the middle of the night, and I've learned, put a note in your phone because I'll have forgotten it in the morning.
It's
true. Yeah.
No, very true. What sort of response have you had to this, you know, being your first book?
Not very good, frankly. I mean, in terms of sales, most people who have read it have liked it and commented favorably. The sales haven't been good, and you know, I understand that it's uphill for any first time author.
Right.
And not to mention, you read how during the pandemic readers tended to more stick with authors they knew. My publisher is not a big name, well-known publisher. I mean, you know, I don't know. And I know it may sound disingenuous, but I never did this for the money.
Right.
And, you know, I'm still doing it, and it's not about the money. It's about the process.
And I mean, if you get one review from somebody who's read it and they say something like, oh, you know, I couldn't put the book down or it
made
me think or something like that, you know, that makes it all worthwhile. That really does.
Yeah.
I remember there was,
you know, I've got,
go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, I was going to say that there was one lady who bought the book for my YA book for her son. She said, "Oh, you know, he's a teenager. He doesn't really read at all. So I thought I'd get one of your books for him because, you know, it's that sort of stuff that he might like." Anyway, she said, "I brought the book home and he sat down and he read it from front to back." She said, "I've never seen him sit like that before." And then she says, "Well, I couldn't believe it. So I picked it up to read it. And I found myself doing the same, picking up different things to what her son had done, but she read it. And blow me down," she said, "the next day, her mother picked it up and read it as well. So it went through three generations. They all enjoyed it. I couldn't ask for any more."
You know, isn't that interesting about YA, how adults pick up on some titles? You'd never expect that. Yeah.
You asked me about
how this had done, and I just want to add a thought that I've finished a manuscript of the second of a Beaupré 2, I'm calling it now, because it doesn't have a title. And that'll be, you know, I'm sort of trying to get motivated to get into the revision process now. Mm-hmm. So presumably that'll be out, luckily, hopefully, next year. So
did you have any
that'll give me a chance to remark it, right?
Exactly. I mean, and the hardest thing is a lot of people, they think once the book's there and printed, that's the hard work done. Not these days. That's when the hard work starts. I mean, number of people who are totally shocked about how much they'd still have to do themselves. You know, you'd still have to get the word out there. And that's the, as you've said, you know, the hardest thing.
That's very true. And, you know, it's, I'll know more, I'll be better at it the second time around.
Yeah.
Because it was a learning curve on that for me, you know. And I don't care. Even the big publishers are not helping authors with marketing the way they used to.
No.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, and also, it takes a while sometimes for the book to catch on. I always use
it. Does.
Steve Berry comes on the show once a year to go talk about his new book. You know, each year he brings a book out, and I always use him as an example. He spent 10 years with like umpteen rejections on the first sort of 10-15 books, and it was after 10 years of nothing but rejections that finally the market changed, Clive Cussler, and that sort of, you know, became suddenly very popular. And lo and behold, they picked up his first 5 books. The other 4 or 5 he had, he plagiarized and made into other things and stuff like that. And now, of course, he's one of the top sellers around the world and that. But he had 10 years of rejection. So, you know, it can come to it.
Believe me, I know all about developing a thick skin. Okay, I don't even want to tell you how many rejections I had before this thing got...
The pre-printed ones were just ticks in little boxes. They're the worst. You know, not even somebody's taking the time to write you. They're just sort of a pre-printed set of statements and they tick one box, you know. That's not right.
It's not right. You get used to it, though. I mean, it's part of the business. You know, you just... It is what it is.
Yeah,
I hate that expression, but
But it's so you have done, or you're in the process of completing the follow up. Have people asked you for a follow up of sort of something? I can't read it.
Well, that's interesting. I have a clause in my contract that my publisher has first options on my next book.
Yeah.
And I haven't had much contact with them. They're busy with other authors by now. It's been over a year since mine came out.
Right.
But you know, I've got a finished manuscript. I like the story a lot.
Right.
And I think when I get it revised and it passes muster with the freelance guy I work with, who I respect a lot, I think it'll be as good as the first one, you know, and hopefully better received.
Right.
That's all I can say at this point.
I mean, the thing is, as you say, you do get better as you go on from experience, I think, as well. So
yeah,
I'm sure
yeah.
it will be enjoyed. And not just that, I'm sure a lot of people have enjoyed listening to you on this show today, but time is coming to the end. So what I'm going to do now is hand the show over to you so you can tell everybody where they can find out more about you and, of course, your book.
Okay. The best way to find out about me, Barry, is through my website, which is www.johnritterfiction.com. And you can learn about the book, you can learn about me, and you can learn about other stuff. I also have a Facebook author page that you can pretty easily find. My publisher is Touchpoint Press.
Okay.
They are a good source of information about me, and they have a web. They have a website, and you can see all their books. They've done a number of good stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's about it. You know?
Okay. Well, it's been really great chatting to you, John. Perhaps when the second book comes out, you'll come back and chat to us again.
I'd like to very much, Barry. And once again, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Well, there you go. Our guest today, John Ritter, R-I-T-T-E-R. And as he said, his site is John Ritter Fiction, all one word, johnritterfiction.com. Lots of stuff there, reviews and about the book and other bits and pieces. Lots, always good to check out an author's site. Lots of, always find lots of interesting stuff. And his book, Fatal Conceit. Very interesting. Lots of twists and turns and lots of great characters in there. So just to give it a try. Just read about it. It's going to be a good one. And as he said, there's a second one in the pipeline. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy that as well. But me, that's it for this week. Of course, I'll be back on Sunday with my two music shows from 5 to 6 p.m. We have Those Were the Days, music from the 20th century, and it's the second of our shows with a theme of kissing, lips kissing, stuff like that. So we had one show last week, and we had so many songs, I made out a second one for this week. And of course, from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. Eastern on Sunday, we have the Swinging 60s, music from the 60s, not just the British Invasion, but from around the world. So, yes, you will get some Beach Boys. Anyway, that's it for now. Until next week, when I'm back with a couple of fresh guests, of course, I have one thing left to say. Don't forget...